Video Store. My name is Sam Mulberry. Today we are talking about the 2017 film I, Tonya. So let's step into Barrett Fisher's Video Store. Barrett, how you doing?
I'm doing great.
Barrett, what is your history with this film? Is this something you saw back in 2017?
No, this is one of those films I missed in 2017. I mean, I knew it was out. And in fact, for some reason, my wife saw it without me. I think she was with her sister. So yeah, I just missed it. I wanted to see it, but just never got around to it. And we can talk about what great movies there were in 2017. But no, this is the first time I finally got to it.
Oh, so this was your first viewing of this. I didn't realize that. Okay, that's interesting. So then I get to ask you some other questions because you'll remember this. What were your thoughts going into this film about kind of what this was going to be? And then we can talk about kind of how it met or didn't meet those expectations.
Well, you know, I feel like in 2017, when it came out, I wasn't sure I was interested in it in some ways because I wasn't sure what kind of film it was. But this time going into it, I knew a lot more about how it was. I'm not really sure what you would call it. It's not exactly a mockumentary, right?
But it has elements of that.
Yeah. It's a hybrid form, really. It's a mockumentary. It's a dramatization in some ways. So I knew a little more about the technique of the film because I'd read a little bit about it. And then, of course, I went into it. In 2017, I had no history with Margot Robbie. This time, I go into it having watched Barbie and being really impressed by her as an actor. So I went into it, I feel like, with pretty high expectations. Then, of course, I didn't realize that Craig Gillespie had directed it, who directed Lars and the Real Girl, as I mentioned last week. I have a pretty high regard for Gillespie. I don't think that he's an auteur, but I think he's a really interesting director. And so the other film of his that I've seen came out the year after Lars and Real Girl, which was Fright Night, which is a vampire film with Colin Farrell. So I knew all those things going into it this past weekend. So I was really primed to have a good experience.
So let's, before we get to your experience, I'm interested in thinking about Gillespie because I had the same thought. So I've seen three things from him. One of them is literally almost accidentally seeing. So Lars and Real Girl, we watched. I loved that movie. That was such a surprise to me. I had seen this before because one of my colleagues, Sarah Shady, saw it in 2017 and kept saying, like, you've got to watch this movie. It's really interesting. And then I accidentally saw Cruella. And the reason that I say that is we were picking our daughter up from camp and dropping our son off at camp. And there was a 5 or 6 hour window between when we could do pickup and drop off. So we were up in the middle of nowhere and we're like, well, we have to figure out what to do at this time. And this is just as theaters were kind of opening in the first wave of like getting out of COVID. And so that was our way to none of us had an interest in seeing Cruella. It was just like, well, this will burn about 2 hours plus of time. So we went and watched it and it's like, so I'm thinking about these three movies and it's like, wow, I don't have a sense of him as a filmmaker. Although the more I thought about this, the more I was like, well, there are some things that he seems interested in between Lars and this.
Which would be?
I think he's interested. I actually think he is interested in a kind of, there's a kind of empathy in Lars and in this. Mm-hmm. They're very, very, very different movies. Very different in how they're like, this movie is very interested in a particular kind of stylization of how you tell a story, mm-hmm. and certain tricks you use to tell a story. And like Lars seems so different than that.
Yeah, exactly, Sam. And that's why I mean, there are auteurs. I mean, I'm not quite sure how to describe this, but let me think about it this way. I mean, there are auteurs who I can say never made the same movie twice, and yet I see something distinctive about them across those films, right? And I don't quite get that with Gillespie, but I think what he does is he works within particular genres quite well. I mean, the three movies that I've seen, the ones that I mentioned, they're very different in terms of their pacing, of their editing. I mean, they look so different from each other that it's really more of a It's kind of a chameleonic quality that he has as a director. In a sense, that's what the classic a lot. That's what people expect from a lot of the classic studio directors back in the heyday of Hollywood. Like, you just make whatever kind of film we want you to make, and he does that. And yet, at the same time, I will contradict myself a little bit, because I think you're right. I think there is a sense of he is interested in either the underdog or at the other end of the spectrum, the unlikable. You know, I mean, because one of the things I like about this film is the unlikable characters are so darn interesting, and I don't mind spending time with them. And I think back at Fright Night, Colin Farrell, he's a really interesting vampire. So I think, to me, maybe that is one of the things I might argue about him, that he's interested not only in those characters who naturally draw our sympathy, but he's also interested in the ones that are the antagonists as well, without making them cartoon villains.
Yeah, and I think both Lars and this film are, in different ways, are kind of requiring him to toe a line, because it would be very easy for them to fall into a kind of mockery, and they don't. And that's where I think about the empathy part is, like, the first time I saw this going in, and even rewatching this the first time this week, I was like, what is the tone of this movie going to be? I couldn't remember from the first time I saw it, and I was kind of nervous about what the tone was going to be. I was like, I actually think he handles it pretty well in terms of dealing with the character of Tonya Harding, dealing with her background, dealing with some of those things. Now, it's interesting to read reviews, and we'll probably get into this, because not every reviewer agreed that this was handled well, but right. I actually think it kind of was.
Yeah, I think it worked. But I'm glad you said that, because that's another characteristic of Gillespie that connects this film with Lars and the Real Girl. And that is that, as you've already indicated, Sam, Lars and the Real Girl really walks a very fine line. And if you don't think it walks that line successfully, that movie is not going to work for you at all. I mean, that movie could be so cringeworthy. But at least in our estimation, right, he pulls it off. And I think Absolutely. He does the same thing here. I think he walks a really nice tightrope. I mean, I think, you know, in some ways it's a film that is sympathetic to Tonya Harding, right? I mean, Tonya Harding endorsed the film. She was happy with it. But it's also a film that, you know, you could read it other ways as well. And so, to me, one of the things I said in my notes about this film is it's a postmodern film. Mm-hmm. It's a film about undecidability. It's a film about pick your narrative. You know, so the opening where he says, based on irony free, which of course is an ironic remark, right? Based on irony free, wildly contradictory, totally true interviews. To me, that is where the film situates itself, you might say, philosophically and epistemologically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know, absolutely. And I think it sort of wants you to ask those questions, and it's not necessarily interested in answering those questions. And what I like about this is there are lots of films that are or lots of film stories, books, all these things that we're familiar with the unreliable narrator. But I think what's interesting about this is we have so many narrators, and there's so many different ways he shows them to be reliable or unreliable, that by the end, I really struggled in a good way with, like, what do I make of this story now? He's presented all of this to me, and I know that I'm watching a piece of, I'm not watching a documentary. I'm watching a dramatization, which I know by definition has cheats in it, right? You have to, right? It is not the real thing. Even a documentary is not the real thing.
Right.
So you have all these layers of distance, but at the same time, if you're old enough, all this stuff happened and you watched it. So it's like you're playing with these levels of, I don't know. It makes me want to go read more. But even I'm like, man, if I go read more, am I still going to get at the core of this? And maybe that's part of it, is like, can you ever get to the core of something?
Right. Well, you know, when you think about it, I mean, the film, you know, you're 85 or 90% through it. And Tanya's in court and she's getting her sentence. And you could say, well, that's the answer, because the court said this, so therefore that's what happened, and that must be. But because of what we've already seen, we're like, well, that's the judge's perspective on what's happened. But there really is no final authority except you as the viewer. And I'm not even sure that Gillespie is asking you to make up your mind. I think Gillespie is asking you to see, look how impossible it is to make up your mind. You're just going to have to live with all these contradictions. I'm not here to solve them because I don't think they can be solved, and I want to put you through that ringer as well.
Absolutely. So before we dive into this, I want to talk about Margot Robbie, just because that's our impetus for watching this. So you had said in 2017 you didn't have a lot of history with her. I think the only thing that I was I think I was like Wolf of Wall Street, she has a role in. So beyond that, she was like somebody who I knew as a movie star because she was in things, but she was in things I wasn't interested in. So like, you know, she's in Suicide Squad and things like that. I'm like, that's not really movies I find myself wanting to watch. Do you have a Margot Robbie performance that you feel, I mean, you talked about Barbie. Are there other performances since then where you feel like you've really connected with her as an actress?
No, I mean, I as I said, I forgot that she was even in Wolf of Wall Street. I didn't really recall seeing her in anything before Barbie. And I didn't go back to see if I'd missed things. But
maybe I'll remind you of one other then, because I actually, and this was a part that got criticized, but I think maybe people have come around on. I think she's great in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood as. Why am I blanking on Sharon Tate? I actually think that's a really great performance.
Oh, how do you like that? Yeah. I mean, I should have looked at her filmography. She was excellent in that. You're right. I totally forgot about that. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, to me, that's the part where I feel like, and it's about somebody who's coming into their own as a movie or about like to come into their own as a movie star. And I feel like that was my real introduction to her, even though I had seen I, Tonya, even I was like, okay, Margot Robbie's got it. Like, there's something really special here.
Well, I'll turn that into a compliment to her as a way to excuse my inattentiveness. Sharon Tate, Barbie, Tonya Harding. I can't imagine three different characters.
Right.
Right. And the fact that she disappears into each of those roles, and I didn't even remember that she was Sharon Tate, I think that says something about not her performance is unmemorable, but the exact opposite, that it is memorable. And I never looked at Tonya and thought, oh, that was Sharon Tate or Barbie. I never thought that either.
Yeah, absolutely. No, and I think, and she's also multiple Tonyas in this movie. Like there are, you know, and sometimes that doesn't work well in a biopic where you're like, well, I don't know that I buy this version of her. But there's something about the difference between the Tonya you see figure skating and the Tonya you see being interviewed.
Mm-hmm.
The passage of time is not just in the like physical appearance, but just even in like the degree to which she is and isn't reflective on it, I think comes across really well in those interview scenes.
Well, I will demur a bit. I'm not quite sure she pulls off 15-year-old Tonya when she moves in with Jeff Galooly. But the other thing that does work for me is, even though I obviously remember the actual Tonya Harding, and if you had said to me, who would be a good Tonya Harding, I would never have said Margot Robbie.
Right.
She's too tall. She's too willowy compared to Harding. But you forget that. And even at the end, when you see the real Harding, it's like, yeah, okay, that actually kind of worked. Because I think she does a lot of it with, it's a lot of it with her face. And so facially, she really pulls off looking more like Tonya. But that's always the challenge in a biopic. That's why some biopics work for me and some don't. Because otherwise, you can get a kind of weird effect where they look close enough to the person they're supposed to be, but not exactly. And then it's kind of an uncanny valley effect in a way. But that didn't happen for me.
Before. Yeah. Well, what's funny about this is I feel like we have enough distance from the 90s and from Tonya Harding that like eventually I kind of forgot what Tonya Harding looked like until you get to the end and see her and you're like, oh yeah, that's what she looked like.
Yeah.
But it's as familiar as she was at one point, I feel, and that is also maybe speaks to this movie, you know, that at least she makes the claim that she's like the second most famous person in the world at one point. It's like, yeah, but I don't really remember what you look like. So what is your memory of this incident? Cause this is a historical event we both lived through. Do you have much memory of this in 94?
Obviously I have memory of it. What's interesting to me, Sam, is I remember more about the event than I remember about the aftermath. You know, I mean, I had to read about it to remember that, oh yeah, she actually did go to the Olympics and she had that thing with her lace, and she finished eighth. And so it was kind of an anti-climax to it. So yeah, I remember the reporting on the incident. I remember the TV shots of Nancy Kerrigan in tears, but you know, that's about it. I didn't remember a lot of the details around either the aftermath of her being at the Olympics or even the trial and the decision about that. And I didn't remember Jeff Galooly's mustache. Evidently, you were supposed to remember that, but I did not.
Well, I do. I was a junior in high school and grew up in a kind of an Olympic household where, like, okay, that was a life stopped for the Olympics in the house I grew up in. So I remember the build up to the Olympics and the idea that she was going to get to skate and that was the big question. Mm. And would Nancy be healthy enough to skate? Like, those were the things, like, was this something that was going to get karmically decided on the ice or, you know, that kind of thing. And then I remember watching the event, and it's what's so funny if you don't know the story about the shoelace thing is you're like, that seems absurd. Mm-hmm. But I remember in the moment sitting in front of the TV watching that and thinking, what is happening? This is the moment that for a big portion of the world, all of our eyes are on this. And then something that never happens in front of you and you're all watching it. And it's confusing because, unlike in the movie where you're here, where, like, you're with Tanya and that, and she's talking about it, she just stops skating and you're confused. Like, so the way it's depicted here was it's like it brought back this memory I had forgotten about. So I like that. And then the other thing I remember, and that's what this movie is really interested in, is the sort of tabloid media cycle. And I kind of forgot what that was like in the 90s, because I do think it's different now because information moved a little bit slower back then. I mean, this is one of the last, this and OJ are like among the last pre-internet big kind of cultural tabloidy events like that. I guess Monica Lewinsky, it would be the third. So the 90s had a bunch of these, and they stayed in the pop culture consciousness for such a long time, where I feel like now we metabolize that stuff so much faster that I don't know that it would have the same hold. It would be among a million other things that everybody looks at and comments on and moves on from. But back then, this was this thing that just kept going throughout 94 and into 95. I feel like you still kept hearing references or more parts of that story coming out.
Yeah, and of course, you get towards the end, you get one of the scenes, OJ is playing in the background, so, you know, it's a perfect kind of overlap. And Bobby Cannavale, as Martin Maddox, the reporter, he talks about this, right? He talks about the fact that the networks looked down upon this kind of journalism until that's what they turned into. So there's a way in which this is really kind of, it's poised at that point before, you know, sensationalism actually kind of becomes the mainstream of how journalism works.
And the other thing I would say about this time period is I remember, as much as we were an Olympics household, like, I, around between 88 and through 94, I started to grow an aversion towards judge sporting events, because I felt like I didn't understand them and I felt like there was something else going on. Now, I realize they've changed the way some of this judging works now, but this just played into it. It sort of oddly reminded me of those feelings of, like, feel like I was watching things and, like, the deck was already stacked. Like, we already knew who was going to be the people at the top, and almost nothing they could do would keep them from that. I remember just feeling that way. And this story kind of played into that. So it's interesting to, you know, again, this film is from Tanya's point of view, but she's definitely another piece of this is attacking the skating system a little bit too, in terms of, you know, what is and what isn't acceptable.
Yeah, and yeah, exactly, and that's something obviously to get more deeply into in terms of to what degree does the skating world want a certain image to be projected, and what happens if you don't have that image? So, you know, that first time we see her skating to ZZ Top sleeping bag, it's quite clear this is not the kind of music. These are not even the kind of moves that they're looking for. So the idea that somehow, you know, you're being judged as Tanya wants to be. You're being judged on your actual skill. There's a sense that, no, the deck is stacked against her because she doesn't come from the right side of the tracks, which is another big theme in the film.
So I was thinking about this movie and I was trying to say, okay, and you touched on this a little bit, like, what is the genre of this film or subgenre of it? And here's the list I came up with that I feel like it is all of these things. It is a biopic.
Yeah.
It is a sports movie. In some senses, it's a true crime story.
Yeah.
It is a mockumentary in the way that they structure it around these interviews. Although at the same time, they're saying, well, these actually are we've refilmed them, but these are the interviews. And they do a little bit where they show some clips where it's like, in fact, this is kind of the interview, just restaged. It is a comedy in its tone a little bit, a comedy or tragicomedy a little bit. Yeah. It's definitely a social commentary, and it's a upsetting domestic drama too. And that's part of the tightrope, is like to do all of those things and tell a story everybody or lots of people are very familiar with. That's a lot to try to do in the film. And again, I think that's where the tone gets really complicated.
And I'll add one more to your list, Sam. It's not exactly a musical, but there is so much music in this film that is so spot on in the way that it comments on the action, that the lyrics of these songs actually becomes kind of part of the screenplay. And maybe I resonated with it more than I usually do with soundtracks, not only because it was, you know, some critics thought it was pretty heavy-handed, and maybe it was, but the music that is picked is the music I grew up with and the music that Tanya grew up with. And so to me, that I can't imagine this film without a half dozen of those songs that kind of play as a commentary. I mean, beginning with when Lavona takes her to the rink and you get Cliff Richard singing Devil Woman, it's like, okay, I can see where we're going with this. So I would kind of add that into the mix.
Absolutely. No, and I think it's interesting to think about those criticisms, because a lot of it was like, well, these are the most obvious needle drops you could do. At the same time, if you were to do sort of the opposite type needle drops, well, that also seems obvious as a filmmaker, I think, too, to be like, oh, we're going to play something that's completely incongruent. Or if you were to use a traditional score for these things, doesn't that also then feel like the judge is saying, no, you can't play this music, you have to play this? Like, it's like, I think the fact that it is pop music, you know, from the time period actually speaks also to the to Tanya's sensibilities a little bit too. She would make the obvious music choices for her, which may not seem obvious in other ways.
Well, that's one of the jokes that musical jokes that Gillespie puts in, because you have, if I'm getting this sequence right, when she first kisses Galooly, Jeff, you get Dire Straits' Romeo and Juliet, which is a perfect commentary. The next thing happens, she kisses her mother goodbye to Vivaldi's Four Seasons. So it's kind of like even Gillespie is playing this joke about pop music versus kind of classical music. So I just and then the curve he throws at the end is Doris Day singing Dream a Little Dream of Me. I just think it's really fun what's going on with the music.
So this movie, as we talked about, is very interested in sort of the idea of truth. We get that in that title card. And like you said, almost more interested than what is the truth. It's like, well, let's think about what we mean when we say truth, you know. So we have, I think, five narrators in this movie. At certain points, five different people take over the narration. You have Tanya and Jeff are the main people. Yeah. You also get Lavona inserting herself into the narrative, and there'll be moments where a scene will get interrupted by a different narrator and to get a commentary on it. You get Diane Rawlinson, the one coach, who's in it a little bit less, and Martin Maddox, the Bobby Cannavale character, in it a little bit less, but they're also kind of like people who aren't as inside on this, taking a step back and making comments as well. So that adds to kind of the, not only are the narrators unreliable, but we don't even always know who's in control of the story. I love the moment when Lavona says, my storyline kind of drops out here. So it's like she's commenting on the project as a whole and saying, I don't know that I should be taken out of this story. I still have things to say.
Yeah, I suppose that's part of the documentary, but even more than that, it's this meta cinematic moment, right? Because the fact that she's commenting on something which is not exactly a documentary, but it's actually a fiction film at the same time, gives it even more kind of texture. And I love the fact that she's piratical with that parrot on her shoulder.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But that, we get the one clip of her in the credits where you realize, oh, that's actually just a that's just a real thing.
That's right, exactly.
Yeah. There's also you get characters, at least three characters turning to camera and breaking the fourth wall and commenting on action as it's happening. All of this feels a little like, I thought a lot about Adam McKay movies, like The Big Short and things like this. Like, I feel like, and actually Gillespie's most recent movie, I haven't seen it, Dumb Money, about the,
yeah, that's on my list to see.
Yeah. About the, GameStop thing, like it, that feels very Adam McKay. It feels like the type of movie Adam McKay might make. So, so I definitely felt, and I like, you know, I like those. I like The Big Short or a movie like Vice. I find that an interesting way to tell a story. So it seems like this is in conversation with films like that.
What I love about those fourth walls, right, is that you get the one where Tanya's shooting at Jeff with the shotgun, and she turns to the camera and says, "I didn't do this."
Yes.
And then you get her out in the woods doing the training routine, and Diane turns the camera and says, "She actually did this." So not only are they breaking the fourth wall, but they're doing it to say what you're seeing actually happened or what you're seeing didn't happen. And we're dramatizing that for you.
Well, and what I find interesting about that is they don't do it too much.
No.
So it leaves me to wonder when I'm watching other things like, well, you didn't give me the guidepost to tell me whether this did or didn't happen, so I don't know what to think of the other things I'm seeing. Because you have at times showed me something and then said it didn't happen, and you have at times shown me things and said it did happen. So when you're not commenting, what do I make of what I'm seeing? I really like that of like it. Those moments forced me to think about every other moment and say, well, is this really what happened? Is this really how it happened? Because he's not giving us. He's giving us a few moments to point that out and then saying, well, these are their stories. What do you think?
Well, but even more than that, Sam, when Tanya turns to the camera and says, this didn't happen, I'm not so sure. Mm-hmm. When Diane tells me this did happen, I'm like, yeah, okay, I'll believe her. So I think I actually think we have narrators with various levels of reliability, right? So I never think that Tanya is an entirely reliable narrator because I can see I can see gaps between what she says and what she does. Whereas Diane and certainly Bob, you know, Martin Maddox, Bobby Cannavale, you know, I can look at them and say, well, they're closer to reliable narrators than the others are. So
right, but. There's a little piece of me that says, well, why do I trust Diane more than anybody else? Isn't she just another person who's involved in this story? You know, like the things she's saying, she actually did this, are also scenes where Diane is overseeing her training. So it's like, well, is she celebrating? Like, again, I believe you. I mean, and I think the same way, like I believe her, but it does make me stop and say, but why do I believe when she tells me that? But when Tanya tells me something, I'm like, well, I don't know. Like I have reasons why I do that, but it makes me question that. Like, why are some of these people, I feel like, oh yeah, they're a more legitimate voice that I'm going to trust here.
Right. You know? Right.
Yeah. Especially because Diane is a character. If we're thinking about the different kind of versions of class in this, Diane is coming from a different class. So isn't it interesting that you trust that person, but you don't trust, you know, like, again, I understand why, but it is asking you that.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. Absolutely.
So I was reading some quotes from the screenwriter and from Gillespie and the screenwriter, Steve Rogers, says, this film is really about the things we tell ourselves in order to live with ourselves, how we change the narrative and want that to be the narrative. And what's cool about this movie is you're seeing, and they don't overplay this, but you're seeing Jeff and Tanya in their interviews fighting over control of the story.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like it is Tanya's story. I mean, it's called I, Tanya, but Jeff is there to like, to also fight over this. One of my favorite moments in the movie in terms of the storytelling conceit is after the 91 Nationals, when she hits the triple axel and they both say after the triple, everything changed.
Yes.
But they say it simultaneously, but in a very different tone. And I was like, okay, so what you're telling me is even if we're saying this happened, what we're going to contest is what does it mean that it happened? You know, and I really liked that moment, because it's maybe the one time where we go split screen simultaneously talking, and that as a piece of storytelling, I loved that little moment.
Yeah, that is a great moment, and what's great about it is that they're agreeing, but then you still get two different versions of exactly what that looks like when they say mm-hmm. it changed.
So. Yeah. So Gillespie said that this film was a great opportunity to revisit the story and make a commentary on how the media treats people. Mm. Do you think that's what this movie's about?
No. I think you know, trust the tale, not the teller, is
right.
The important said. I think that is such a mischaracterization, and I don't know whether Gillespie doesn't understand his own movie, which I greatly doubt. I just think that's the best way to promote the movie, to make people mm-hmm. think that's what they're seeing, but that's not what they're seeing at all. I mean, Tanya has been. I mean, if it's a movie about mistreatment, it's about domestic mistreatment. It's not about media mistreatment. I mean, you know, there is a sense in which you could say she's mistreated by the media, because we get into that whole, you know, she's not the wholesome image of America that we want to see. I mean, I guess you know, there's a kernel of truth in that, but if you told me that was your elevator speech for this film, or that was your blurb for this film, I would say I'm not interested in that movie.
Yeah, that sounds like a TV movie that I'm not going to watch.
Yeah, exactly.
So what's interesting is there is something, I think, something about America in the way we look at celebrity in this film, for sure. One of the first thing we hear Diane say when they're like introducing the conceit of the interviews is she says, generally people either love Tanya or are not a big fan, just like America. Either people love America or are not a big fan. Tanya was truly American. And then Tanya's final comments in the movie. So like that's at the very beginning of the movie. Tanya's final comments in the movie are also about America. She says, America, they want someone to love. They want someone to hate. They want it easy. There's no such thing as truth. Everyone has their own truth. And life just does whatever it wants. Mm-hmm. That's the story of my life. And that's the truth.
Yeah. Yeah.
So there, it's both this thinking about this story in particular, but then also thinking about what we want in story, right? This is what America wants. And sort of this notion of celebrity a little bit. And I mean, there's also a part where it's right after the incident, and everybody's like, there's all the reporters around Tanya, and she says something, I don't know if this is in an interview or in a scene, she says something like, I thought being famous was going to be fun. Mm-hmm. You know, I thought it would be nice to be famous. And then it's like the other side of that.
Yeah.
Because infamy is different than fame.
Yeah, I want to bring in Oscar Wilde to talk a little bit about this, Sam. So Wilde has a great quote in the picture Dorian Gray. He says, the 19th century dislike of realism is the rage of Caliban seeing his own face in a glass. The 19th century dislike of romanticism is the rage of Caliban not seeing his own face in a glass. Okay, mm-hmm. I'm going to paraphrase that. Americans' dislike of Tanya is the rage of Caliban seeing his own face in a glass. Americans' dislike of Tanya is the rage of Caliban not seeing his own face in a glass. In other words, I think you can take what Diane says and you can kind of go two directions with it. Like we dislike Tanya because she's not the image that we want to project. Or we dislike Tanya because she is what we realize we are, but we don't want to admit. And then there's a really long tradition of this, right? This idea that we want our heroes, or we want our public faces, to be not only maybe the best version of ourselves, but kind of the fantasy version of ourselves. James Thurber has a great short story from the 1930s called The Greatest Man in the World. And it was written right after Lindbergh had flown the Atlantic, or a couple of years later. And in the story, this guy is an aviator like Lindbergh. And he, I forget what his achievement is, but he kind of outdoes Lindbergh. But it turns out he's completely the wrong image. He's rough. He's rough cut. He's a chain smoker. All he cares about is the money. You know, tell me how much money I'm going to make as a result. And he literally gets thrown out the window. And he also has a mother figure, so significantly enough. Or think about how people responded when Jimmy Carter was president to Billy Carter. You know, the national embarrassment. Or, you know, when Roseanne Barr kind of made it big And you know, these are all people that are being successful, but they're not the kind of people that we want to use to represent America. So I think that's really, that's the Tonya Nancy Kerrigan dynamic, right? Mm-hmm. Right there. So yeah.
Well, and she even comments on the scene where she's like, Nancy and I were friends. They show the scene of them like in a hotel room, both kind of being the same person, you know, and it, like doing the same things together. And you're like, yeah, what I find interesting about that is what it occurred to me is like, I actually don't know anything about Nancy Kerrigan. Like I could describe her to you as how she's different than Tonya, but then I realize that's entirely a narrative I've been told. I don't know. Like, I don't know whether that's accurate or whether she fits a part better. So she gets her story told in a different way. And, you know, like, so that was an interesting little moment for me because it was kind of convicting of like, oh, I could have told you this story, but I don't know whether the story I would have told you about the contrast between these two is how real that is.
Right. Well, do you think they were drinking together in the hotel room?
I don't know.
No, I know. I don't either. And one of the really important and I think key choices the movie makes is that it doesn't do anything with Nancy Kerrigan. Mm-hmm. Now, a couple of reviewers commented on that, and I thought, no, I don't want to see more of Nancy Kerrigan, because the only point of Nancy Kerrigan in this story is the role that she plays in the incident, and the incident is about Tonya. It's not about Nancy Kerrigan. So I think the fact that you don't—I mean, I think she doesn't even get a line; she just gets a yelp. Yeah. when she gets knocked in the knee. So I think that's exactly the right thing that they do with her, that she's just there as kind of this figure, and we kind of fill in what we know or what we remember about her. We don't need her to be made into a real character at all.
Yeah. So, okay. The other thing in the reviews that are critical, this movie got reviewed well, but reading around the edges of this is there are people who are either say the movie does this or are concerned that it might be. Do you think this movie is laughing at Tonya Harding?
No.
That shocked me that people, but that was a tone in a lot of those reviews. And I was like, that is not the movie that I saw.
No, I mean, there are moments of humor in the movie, but I never laugh at her. I mean, I end up thinking that she might be deluded. I end up thinking that she might be complicit, but there's too much sympathy for her. I mean, the way that they build this, the way the relationship with her mother sets her up, and I wouldn't go so far as to say it sets her up as a victim, but it certainly explains to a certain extent why she puts up with Jeff, why in a sense her life is a search for love and affirmation. So this film has a couple of, you know, we talked earlier about the tonal shifts. This has a couple of really gut-wrenching scenes, you know, when her mother hits her with a knife.
Mm-hmm. I love how the movie stops in that moment.
Yeah, it literally stops. And towards the end, when her mother comes to the house and you think they're going to have this moment of, oh, I really love you, and you realize the mother is just trying to entrap her. And, you know, and that sense of the final sense of betrayal. And then in between, the scene when she goes to the restaurant to try to get to talk to her mother about, you know, maybe basically could we maybe have a normal relationship and I can project that to the press. And her mother, you know, rejects her at that point as well. I mean, I think those things build such genuine sympathy for Tonya, because those are not moments in the film, for whatever it's worth, those are not moments in the film when I wonder if this is real or not. To me, those are absolutely real, and they help create her as a sympathetic character.
I also think it's significant that we see, I guess it's not even 4-year-old Tonya, it's a soft 4, so 3-year-old Tonya, and then we see her a little bit older before it's Margot Robbie, and you see that like this movie has a shocking amount of abuse in it, like yeah. for the tone of the movie, and you're like, you might walk out being like, well, that was kind of a fun movie to watch, it was really interesting, but it's like, man, there's some hard stuff in this, and you get this sort of sense of cycles of abuse, you get this sense of like learning, Tonya learns to expect abuse in life. I mean, she talks about that with Jeff. She's, you know, when there's a scene where it's another fourth wall moment where she turns to the camera as they're in bed together and she says, you know, well, my mother hits me and she loves me. So it's like, and then there's the scene where where Lavanna says, "Well, you act like you expect to get hit," and she says, "I wonder where I learned that from."
Yeah,
You know, and how much of that, and the fact that you see her as a little kid, and you see at least one or two moments, you see like three moments of abuse there, where you're like, okay, this is something which is ingrained in her from childhood. So there is a degree to which she may be complicit, she may be all these things, but she definitely is a victim of abuse, without a doubt. And again, you know, that is part of what makes her sympathetic, is you realize like she is having to try to come out of something. That's why the heartbreaking moment in this movie is after Albertville, when she's standing outside the restaurant where she's working, and Diane comes up, and Diane says, "You look good," and she says, "I look like somebody who found a way out and messed it up." Mm. And Diane said, "I was being nice." Yeah. So it was like, it's like she knows that it's like, I had this terrible upbringing, and I got right up to the point of like maybe finding a way out of this and didn't get out.
Yeah. Well, you know, the follow-up to that quote you said earlier, where she says, "My mom hits me, she loves me," she says about Jeff, "He beat the living hell out of me, and I thought it was my fault," right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, one of the things that I really, one of the ways in which my sympathy for her was deepened was, you know, I went into this thinking, well, you know, this Tonya Harding, she's a hard case herself. She can give as good as she gets. But she is, programmed is the wrong word, but right, but she's been kind of trained to accept that kind of abuse and expect it. And her mother seems completely unreflective about what she does to her. I mean, you know, she hits her with the knife, and they all recognize that in some respects she's stepped over a line. But it doesn't cause the mother to change her behavior. And then her mother faults her for allowing Jeff to hit her, as though Lavona doesn't understand the way that she has programmed Tonya. And the irony there is she is trying to program Tonya, right? That she thinks that's the whole point of treating Tonya as she does, because she, Lavona, is a failure because her mother was too nice to her. So she's going to make her daughter a success by not being nice to her. And after a while, you're like, is there any love in there at all? She thinks there's love, but is there? I mean, she's a very complex character in that respect.
There's another great heartbreaking moment where it humanizes Tonya in a kind of way. It's after the 91 Nationals, when she lands the triple and wins, and it's a cutaway to the interview, and she says, "I was the best figure skater in the world for one time," and she starts to cry and says, "I'm sorry, no one ever asks me about this anymore." Mm-hmm. And you realize like her whole life, she has an entire life and a quite remarkable story, but the only thing that matters in her life, this is before we get to the incident, is the incident. And there's this sense of like, can somebody please ask me about this time when I actually was on top of the world? I would like to tell that story too. And like, honestly, like that's this heartbreaking moment, because regardless of the other parts, is like, this is the person who got out to a certain degree, who because of all this, in spite of all this, made it to this kind of pinnacle, and that's been wiped away. And as the movie progresses, you're like, what role did she have in wiping it away, and what to what extent was this the people around her who wiped that away?
Well, I also like it, both visually and thematically, how the triple axle becomes kind of a metaphor, because, you know, there's discussion of, you know, when you pull off this triple axle, I mean, it is a, you're literally on a knife's edge. And the idea is the triple axle is a moment both of incredible power and also incredible control at the same time. And so it becomes a metaphor for all the kind of chaotic forces that she's dealing with that ultimately she really can't control. And to me, the most telling moment of this is also one of the reasons why the film got nominated for Academy Award for editing. At the end, when she takes that final punch in the ring, right? And there's the cut from her doing the triple axel to her spinning around as she falls to the canvas. And to me, that 15, 20 seconds of film expresses everything that's kind of gone wrong in her life, from that apex of the triple axel to the defeat in the ring. And so to ask her about the triple axel is both to ask her about the high point of her life, but also to refer in a sense to the nadir of her life at the same time.
Well, and in that both of those moments are slowed down to the point of being frozen in time.
Yes.
You know, and it's like, could you live in just this one moment? You know, it's sort of thing. But the other thing I love about the triple axel, and this is the good sports movie part of this, because this is like, it's like a superpower she has. Like, it's the thing throughout the movie. You know, we see this kind of at least Tanya's critique of the skating skate judging complex, right? And, you know, we constantly see her, twice confronting judges directly, saying like, I outskated the other people. Why am I not winning? And at least, again, this is Tanya's telling, they're telling her to her face, there's more to it than skating. You're just not the right image. But then she has this one thing that's like, I can do something nobody else in the world can do. And there's this sense where almost it's like, will this break the system? Will this superpower be the thing? It's like, we cannot deny that you can do this thing that nobody else can do. So is that going to force them to have to acknowledge her? But that also then becomes like the thing later, like when she gets to Albertville, that she can't land it. And then we get the refrain that she says probably four or five times in the movie. She turns to camera and says, it wasn't my fault. So that's another like motif in this movie. That's why it's interesting. The line you said of like, he hit me and I thought it was my fault. Mm. It's the only time she says that, because most of the movie is something happened. Yeah. It wasn't my fault.
Yeah, that's right. Well, you know, if the movie does have an axe to grind, I think it is about this idea that we, you know, you talked earlier, Sam, about, you know, not liking sports where there's judgments being made, you know, and I think one of the myths that we want to believe about sports is, and this is, of course, is an issue that comes up every time the Olympics rolls around, is, well, you know, sports is the area where once you get on the field or the arena or whatever it is, once you're out there competing, there's no politics. It's all about the game, and it's all about the rules of the game. And I think if Gillespie's pointing anything out, he's pointing out, no, politics are a big deal with sports, especially with figure skating. So to the degree that the film has more of an agenda, I think that's certainly one of the agendas. And Tanya is a great way for him to make that point. What's complicated, of course, is that Tanya becomes the victim of her own tendencies, or the victim of the people she's surrounded herself with, as much as she's the victim of the sport. So it's not as simple as the world was out to get Tanya. It would have been a lot easier if Tanya hadn't made it so easy for the world to kind of get her, but she did.
Well, and there's also a moment, and again, it's one of those great things where it's like, okay, what's real and what's true here? Because we don't see Tanya skate. We focus on certain moments of her skating, but we don't see it all the time. And the person who's telling us that she outskated everybody else is Tanya. And then there's a moment where the one judge, when she goes to confront them on the ice, says, did you ever think that maybe you're not as good as you think you are? And that moment, almost like the knife hitting Tanya in the arm, was like, oh, wait, am I just trusting her account of this? Because, like, I don't know. You know, the movie isn't showing me that. She's telling me I outskated them. I was the best. And it's like, oh, wait, I've met people who would tell me that about every moment in their lives. And it's like, but did you, or were they actually better? Because I don't know. And like that moment is it goes by quickly, but it's a pretty powerful comment where you're like, okay, let me take a step back. And what do I actually know?
But I also think that, at least as I was watching it, and maybe I was just not being very reflective, but I think it's also an evidence of how much sympathy I had gained for Tanya, that when she said that to the judges, I didn't really doubt it. I thought, oh, yeah, she's right. She's actually not being treated fairly. Although, as you said, I really had no independent way to verify that.
Yeah, it's what this movie does to your head, is like, once it starts to ask you about, well, what is truth and what is how do people craft a narrative? You're like, shoot, I don't know. I don't know what I can trust. I didn't have time to do this, but it made me want to go back and watch there's a good 30 for 30 about this. And I was like, oh, I should watch that too, to be like, what is a more journalistic account of this? Because like, this movie gets into my head, and I mean, I find myself quite the opposite of laughing at Tanya. Like, my heart breaks for this person, and I wonder if it should. Like yeah. It's for certain things, it definitely does, but there are others when you get to the end, it's like, I don't even know. The movie doesn't want to tell me how involved she is or isn't. One of the things that's so interesting, and I love this seems like almost like a Coen's Brothers kind of plot line, but the idea of, like, there is this whole plan in place to either scare Nancy or attack Nancy. And at the same time that's going on, Tanya's just skating great. And you're like, wait a minute, what if they didn't do any of this? Would she have just made the Olympic team? Maybe, like, maybe the training yeah. and all this is so there's like, the plan was because she wasn't going to be good enough and we needed to get rid of Nancy. It's like, but maybe you didn't need to get rid of Nancy. Yeah, maybe at the same time you were doing that, you also did this other, you were also doing the hard work of making it, you know?
Yeah. It's like sometimes when you find that a student has gone to great lengths to cheat, you want to say, well, if you'd gone to the same lengths just to play it straight, you would have been okay. But, you know, I want to go back to what you said earlier about a more journalistic account of this. I think one of the ways in which this movie has messed with my head is I don't know that I would necessarily regard a, quote, more journalistic account as any more authoritative, because right. that's exactly what this movie is trying to tell you. Don't trust those clear tellings of this is exactly what's going on, because the truth is always more complicated than that. So. Right.
At the same time, the yes. movie feels like it's telling you, like, but let's try to get to the truth of this. At the same time, it's like, how do you do that? And all that then leads to, again, another really humanizing, heartbreaking moment is when she's standing in front of the judge at the end and she's just like, please just give me prison time, like, and let me skate, because yeah. and that's another moment where I assume she said something like that, but I don't doubt the sentiment of that, which is like, okay, I have just seen this person who everything around her and herself was driven towards this one point, and it meant sacrificing education. It meant sacrificing all these other things. And she's standing there as a 23, 24 year old and saying, I actually don't know how to do anything else but skate. And I'm really good at skating. And if you take that away, like, I think she says it might as well be a life sentence. Like, I there's not another thing for me to do. Which makes her pivot to boxing, which actually happens. Yeah. Also so interesting, because the line she says about that is, all my life, all I've ever known was violence. And you're like, oh goodness, is this where this story, like, inevitably needs to lead? And you know, there's even something with it. So I just feel like this movie makes me so sympathetic towards Tanya that I actually do wonder, like, not that I want her in the movie, but, like, how does somebody like Nancy Kerrigan watch this movie? Mm-hmm. You know, because as much as this story is not her story, the incident story is attached to her story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I also found interesting the moment where, and I feel like I've seen the interview clip where she says this, where Tanya is talking about, like, I went to the Olympics in Lillehammer, I finished eighth, and I was happy with that. Nancy mm-hmm. finished second and acted like she had stepped in poop and was like, you know, and there is this sense of like,
yeah.
I mean, because that speaks again to sort of the entitlement of what this movie is saying about the skating world is like, these people are expected to be there. And if they're not there, I mean, it's almost like she's saying, Nancy was saying, it's not my fault. It's like, which is the thing Tanya keeps saying.
Well, I mean, it's interesting when that real Tanya shows up at the end of the film, because that's the Tanya that I could not imagine having sympathy for until before I watched this film. So when she shows up at the end, I mean, it's interesting to think about, you know, like, what effect does that have on you as the viewer? Do you think, oh, I remember now, she really wasn't as likable as this film made her look, or as sympathetic? Or do you say, oh, I now see this real life Tanya through a very different lens as a result mm-hmm. of the film. To me, that was one of the ways in which the film really worked, because she shows up at the end and I'm like, oh yeah, she really did talk that way. She really was pretty rough. But now I feel kind of bad for disrespecting her because of that.
So two other things that I want to talk about. One of them is a name we haven't mentioned yet, which is Paul Walter Hauser as Sean, mm-hmm. oh. Which is, I mean, clearly played as, at one level played as a comic relief character. And that's why I'm glad that they do show the video clip of him at the end, because yes. I have seen footage of this guy, and he is, there's a degree to which it's like, he's as he seems as delusional as the Sean in the movie seems. And because of this, like, he causes you to question Jeff, because it's like, this is Jeff's best friend. Okay. Yeah. What do I make of that? He also is interesting, because as much as he seems like this delusional gas bag talking about his counterterrorism training, like, and Tanya calls him out on that, and it's like, yeah, there's nothing in this movie that points to that. It's like, but people like that, or at least in the case of Sean, who you think are like harmless gas bags who just like to talk, it's like, he actually led to the perpetration of this attack, which shows you, like, it's important that we don't ignore the people like that too, because they at least have in them the potential to, as Sean proclaims, I have changed the course of history, you know? And like, what happens when you ignore somebody like that? That is, you don't get his story, but that is a character who through his, maybe because of his own delusion, has been sort of beaten down by the people around him. Although his family seems very lovely and supportive. Even to the FBI. But he actually does send people out who, you know, I'm sort of thankful they didn't kill Nancy Kerrigan, because you know, you watch this movie and you're like, what could they have done, and thought they were acting within their delusion, you know? So the other thing I want to say about this movie is this movie looks pretty great. I'm going to point to three scenes that I think are just gorgeous. They're all two of them are tracking shots. The first is one of the early scenes where she's about to skate. I think it's before she skates to the ZZ Top. You get this long tracking shot through like the locker room, and you keep seeing skaters enter and cross the camera as the camera's moving. And what I love about it is I keep looking for Tanya. It's like, okay, which one of these is going to be Tanya? Which one's going to be Tanya? And it keeps going, and you keep seeing all these skaters who all kind of look the same. Mm-hmm. The same build, the same hair, the same, and then it finally gets out of the locker room into like the dark hallway outside the rink, and you see Tanya there smoking, and she also looks just physically different than the others, because that was part of Tanya Harding, is both in her style, but also like she was like a powerfully built skater, and so you get this contrast. But I love the, like, I keep searching for where Tanya's going to show up. And it's not until the very end where it's like, oh, here she is. And it also physically shows her on the outside of the skating world, right? That locker room is the skating world, and she is on the outside, and she's smoking. And it's like, okay, this is her position relative to the skating world. Yeah. The second shot was the Goodbye Stranger, the camera moving through the house, where I think we see three or four Jeffs in the house as the camera is moving. And then it goes out and drives away, and it's just it's a great depiction of somebody leaving someone's life. Mm-hmm. And what that does to them. I thought that was great. But the big thing to me is how great the skating footage is. Because that's a challenge with a sport that most people have only seen on TV, is we're actually used to seeing this on a screen. So how do you film it? How do you film it? Do you film it exactly like it would have looked on TV? In which case, well, that's weird, because you have the real footage of it, but instead they put you on the ice with her, very close, often long, again, kind of tracking shots with the camera moving. So moving around her. And I mean, they have to do the trickery, because Margot Robbie is not a top tier figure skater. She does a lot of her own skating. They use body doubles for other things. And I think the triple axel is the one thing where they actually this speaks to Tanya's talent. They actually couldn't find somebody who could do a triple axel. So they had to fake, that's the thing they had to fake with CGI, because they couldn't find somebody to pull that move off. But this is going to be an overstatement, and I'm going to say this, and I don't mean this to the extent, but like, it reminded me of when I watched Raging Bull, and like, he puts you in the ring really close up, and in this kind of point of view, I'm like, oh, this is a really great perspective on what it feels like to be on the ice, to be moving at the speed of the skater sometimes, to be up close. And I'm not saying this is what Scorsese does in Raging Bull, but there is this sense of like, those scenes are really, I think, are well done to put you up close and to convince me that is Margot Robbie out there. I feel like there's a lot of bad CGI in the world, and I feel like this movie does it pretty well.
I thought so too. One critic I read faulted the CGI, but I didn't see any issues with it. I thought it was amazing, actually. I kept saying, I know it's not Margot Robbie most of the time, but I can't tell. So, yeah.
Do you have anything else you want to talk about with this movie?
Yeah, just two brief things, Sam. I wanted to comment on the title, I, Tonya, which invokes both I, Claudius, and which maybe Livona is the stand-in for the Empress Olivia, who knocks off a lot of her opponents, and also maybe I, Robot at the same time. So I think he's just got, again, it's another way in which the movie is slyly ironic. Like, it's not I, Robot, it's not I, Claudius, but he's kind of trying to elevate. It's as though the movie is saying, we are white trash, but we're going to put ourselves in the company of these prestige movies. And the other thing, which we haven't brought up, is this whole notion of the undecidability of the narrative. And it takes us back to Rashomon. There's a way in which that's kind of the pedigree of this film, is going all the way back to Kurosawa's classic film.
So what do you have for us for next week, Barrett? How do we follow this up?
I've been doing this kind of look back to 2023 as inspiration. And, 2023, Ryan O'Neill left us. And so I think the best way to celebrate Ryan O'Neill is to watch Barry Lyndon, Stanley Kubrick's great 1975 film.
I'm so excited. I love this movie. Oh, this is going to be great. This is one that I've been telling my daughter. It's like, we need to like set aside 3.5 hours because I really want to watch Barry Lyndon with you. So now I get to do that this weekend. I'm very excited. Very excited for this. Oh, that's Barry. You just made my weekend. That's going to be fantastic. Thank you so much for recommending this film and having this conversation. I think this is a movie I think a lot of people slept on. We didn't talk about 2017, but 2017 is one of the great movie years. We watched Lady Bird a couple months ago from 2017. You also get, but Get Out is from 2017.
Three Billboards and Frances McDormand gets Best Actress. Sally Hawkins in Shape of Water. It's amazing. Allison Janney does get the Oscar for supporting.
Well deserved too.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Everybody predicted it and it came true.
so a great movie year, but I think this is a movie that kind of slips through people's fingers. And I think to your point of like, you see it and like, I don't know that I want to watch a Tonya Harding movie. Let us just tell you, maybe you do. It's actually really, really good. And it's great to see Margot Robbie, who's definitely kind of maybe at her up to now apex of her career. She still has up to go, but it's good to see her in this, because I think you're right. It does contrast with other roles that she plays. So thank you for recommending this, for having this conversation. That is all the time that we have, but we will be back next week to talk about Barry Lyndon in The Video Store.